We absolutely want to ensure that we have integrity with the ballots, and we look forward to obviously getting our case heard in Juneau.
Joe Miller's lawsuit against the state gets moved from Fairbanks to Juneau. From the Alaska Public Radio Network, this is Alaska News Nightly for Monday, the 29th of November. Good evening, I'm Lori Townsend. Also tonight, most Alaskan conversations don't involve talk of breakup this time of year, unless you're on the Kuskokwim.
High water level, I'd say 10, 15 high, just like our springtime breakup.
Those stories and more tonight on Alaska News Nightly.
Today's broadcast of Alaska News Nightly is presented by Northern Air Cargo. For over 54 years, Alaskans have entrusted Northern Air Cargo to transport their freight. Thank you, Alaska, for the opportunity to serve you for decades to come.
Fairbanks Judge Douglas Blankenship ruled this afternoon that Republican U.S. Senate candidate Joe Miller's lawsuit against the State Division of Elections should be heard in Juneau. Blankenship said it's too inconvenient for the state to be involved in a case in Fairbanks. Blankenship did not decide whether Senator Lisa Murkowski could intervene in the case. Miller had this reaction to the latest chapter in the fight over Alaska's Senate campaign.
From our perspective, I think the court was very conscientious in his review of the file, recognizing that there are serious issues that are likely to be resolved in this case. We certainly don't want to hold up the process. We're going to work, as aggressively as what we would have worked in Fairbanks and Juneau, and we look forward to getting a fair hearing there as well.
Miller filed his case in Fairbanks and said he had wanted the case to be heard there for a variety of reasons.
So this is where I reside. This is where I think a lot of voters are very concerned about the outcome. Obviously, a plurality of voters in the Fairbanks North Star Borough supported our candidacy. But the judge made a well-balanced decision based upon the state's argument that because there may be a need for ballot review, that there may be a need for other issues relating that require some sort of factual resolution, that it would be appropriate to have the proceeding.
Miller's suit alleges state elections officials broke Alaska law by accepting some write-in ballots that had rival candidate Murkowski's name misspelled on them. Lieutenant Governor Craig Campbell and the State Division of Elections Director Gail Fanumiai have stated that voter intent is the driving factor in accepting a write-in ballot as valid. Murkowski has declared victory in her write-in campaign with a more than 10,000 vote lead over Miller, a total that includes more than 8,000 ballots contested by Miller's observers. But Miller says he thinks he can pick up some extra votes if the court side with him.
The circus that we saw in Juneau over the last several weeks was a result of a changing standard. It was a standard that was not clearly set out at the very beginning. We saw the change in the way that ballots were treated throughout the process. Our concern initially, of course, was that we were not able to assemble a team in an orderly fashion. We had the movement of the date from the 18th to the 10th, and we know for a fact that there are ballots that ended up going into the unchallenged category that, in fact, should have been in the contested category.
Miller is seeking to block certification of the general election, which elections officials had hoped to certify today. Miller told reporters in Fairbanks today that he wants a recount.
We had a machine count of our ballots that did not capture all of the ballots that may have been cast for Joe Miller. She had a hand count, which included ballots that were not counted by machines. So when you're talking about less than 1% of the uncontested vote, I think it would be silly at this point to stand back and say, oh, we aren't going to pursue this.
Miller is also contesting Murkowski's intervention in the suit. Attorneys for Miller say only the state can deal with enforcement of state law. For some residents along the Kuskokwim River, Thanksgiving meant more than just eating lots of turkey. It meant preparing for a flood. A large stretch of the river experienced breakup over the holiday weekend. From member station KYUK in Bethel, Angela Denning Barnes reports.
It happened around dinner time on Thanksgiving Day at Aniak, a village about 150 river miles up from Bethel. People who planned to have a relaxing dinner at home ended up outside on the riverbank. Wayne Morgan is the chief of the Aniak tribe and a lifelong resident.
The word spread and people went down to, you know, just like breakup, we would in springtime. People went down to, observe and what is happening.
Over the past several days, the upper and middle portions of the Kuskokwim River experienced breakup for the second time this year. Upriver villages like Sleepmute and Stony River, about 300 river miles from Bethel, saw their ice move about a week ago. The river is smaller and faster there, and Morgan says the reports didn't shock residents in Aniak.
Down here, I said, oh, it won't happen down here. It must be real thin ice up there. Nothing will happen down here, so I don't think any residents down here think anything would happen.
But that all changed on Thanksgiving Day. Morgan and others in Aniak heard that the ice was moving in Tuathpilluk, just 10 miles upriver. At first, many people thought it was just some thin ice that was pressured by recent rainfall. But by evening, river ice was moving bank to bank in front of the village, and no one could deny what was happening.
High water level, I'd say 10, 15 high, just like our springtime breakup. To move that ice that was there already, it was about 6 to 8 inches thick already on the river. But it just broke that up and lifted it up and pushed it downriver.
Temperatures in the 40s, mixed with 2.5 inches of rain, mixed with 0.5 foot of melting snow, was just the recipe needed for an early winter breakup. Morgan, who grew up in Aniak, had never seen anything like it. There was a smaller late fall breakup in 2002, but it did not stretch for a couple hundred miles on the river like this one. Aniak experienced some minor flooding this year. One low-level road in town had water on it, but Morgan says most of the breakup activity stayed on the waterways. Morgan says the ice is just a mess now, with towering jumbles of ice stretching across the river. He doesn't see an ice road for vehicles getting put in this year that would connect Aniak to villages downriver.
It's so rough out there. There's some 6 to 10 foot sheets of ice, piled up, everywhere. It's bad.
Although the ice has stopped at Aniak, it was still moving in other areas of the Kuskokwim as of Sunday night. The lower part of the Kuskokwim River near Bethel was also in jeopardy of breaking up, but the recent cooling trend has restarted the freeze-up process. Last year at this time, there was about a foot more of ice on the lower river near Bethel, with a truck trail already established. In Bethel, I'm Angela Denning-Barnes.
The 19-year-old Somali immigrant who the FBI alleges tried to detonate what he thought was a bomb in a Friday Christmas tree lighting ceremony in Portland, Oregon, had reportedly tried to travel to Kodiak for a summer fishing job. KMXT's Jacob Resnick reports.
The 38-page affidavit offers a timeline of Mohammed Osman Mohammed's activities when he allegedly contacted Islamic militants in Pakistan. On June 14th, the naturalized U.S. citizen tried to board a flight from Portland bound for Kodiak, but for reasons not yet clear, he was prevented from flying and then questioned by the FBI. Later that month, undercover agents emailed Mohammed, pretending to be Islamic militants. According to court documents, agents met with Mohammed multiple times and supplied cash, logistical support, and advice on how to carry out a bomb attack. Mohammed allegedly chose the Christmas tree lighting ceremony because of the high number of women and children in attendance, which would be in retribution to civilians killed by U.S. forces in Muslim countries. Mohammed was arrested minutes after he tried to detonate what actually was a fake bomb supplied by the FBI. He is being charged with attempted use of a weapon of mass destruction. He is scheduled to appear in court today. If convicted, he faces life in prison. Mohammed's connection to Kodiak isn't clear. He told undercover agents that he had secured a fishing job and a place to stay in Alaska. He later allegedly told undercover agents he was apparently on the no-fly list, which had foiled his ability to raise funds for international travel. Nowhere in the court documents did it suggest he had mulled an attack in Alaska. The Anchorage Daily News reported Sunday that an FBI spokeswoman would not comment further on Mohammed's attempted trip to Kodiak. Reaction to news of the plot has already sparked violent backlash against Oregon's Muslims. An early Sunday arson attack on a mosque in Mohammed's hometown of Corvallis destroyed much of the structure. The Oregonian newspaper reports that the FBI is investigating and offering a $10,000 reward for information leading to a conviction in connection with the crime. In Kodiak, I'm Jacob Resnick.
Still to come on Alaska News Nightly, speculating on Alaska's possible next big resource bonanza, water.
And we have found that water transport bags are, in fact, much more reliable and cost-effective as opposed to subsea pipelines.
That's ahead. Stay with us.
Alaska News Nightly is brought to you in part by your local public radio station. ACHEA, the Alaska Comprehensive Health Insurance Association, has been asked to administer the new temporary federal insurance program that allows individuals with a qualifying pre-existing condition and who have been uninsured for at least 6 months an opportunity to purchase health insurance. Capacity is limited, so contact an insurance broker or ACHEA immediately. More information at ACHIA.com. This message sponsored by ACHEA Fed.
The conviction of Congressman Don Young's former aide, Mark Zacharias, who was convicted for taking gifts from corrupt lobbyist Jack Abramoff, left hanging the identity of two lawmakers referenced in his trial. Zacharias could have faced years in prison, but prosecutors requested a lighter sentence because he helped investigate two congressmen in the Abramoff influence peddling scandal. Prosecutors did not identify the congressmen, referring to them in documents as only A or B, but said they ultimately were not charged. Anchorage Daily News investigative reporter Richard Maurer has been following the story. He says we may never know the names of Congressman A or Congressman B.
I haven't found out a heck of a lot about either congressman. In some ways, Congressman Young, who employed Zacharias, he could match either one of those, but so could probably dozens of other congressmen. So it's really the smidgens of evidence that have surfaced about who they are, which is two or three sentences in a legal document, is nowhere near enough to make an identity.
Congressman Young has said the investigation of him is over. Mm-hmm. And if it's truly over, will it be possible to get Department of Justice records released in this case?
No, not at all. Those kinds of records are not subject to disclosure under the Freedom of Information Act. They will be locked up probably forever, or at least for quite a while. So the answer is not. The thing about the notice that went to Congressman Young, I mean, it's a phone call from the Justice Department to his attorney. It's not a letter. It's not any formal kind of statement that says you are now free to go about your life for now and forever. It's a pretty straight statement, and something would have to change very dramatically for them to rescind that. But it's not a complete pass, I guess it would be the way to say that.
Explain that to me. What do you mean by it's not a complete pass?
This is my understanding from talking to several attorneys who are criminal defense attorneys in the federal bar. In a situation where there's a long investigation, some of the information becomes public and involves someone prominent. If the investigation goes nowhere, the defense attorney for the person being investigated, the subject, may get a call at some point and from the Justice Department that says something to the effect of we're not investigating this, we're not actively investigating anymore, we don't expect to bring an indictment, we're not going to try and bring an indictment, the case appears to be over. And that's what happened in the case of Don Young, I believe. That's certainly what his lawyer seemed to say. But that's different than a letter from the Justice Department granting someone, say, immunity. He could say with absolute honesty that he is not being prosecuted, but that does not mean that there's no chance he would ever be again.
What kind of impact did the Supreme Court's changes to the honest services law have in this case?
The judge in the case noted that one of the reasons that Congressman A or Congressman B were not charged was because of the changes in honest services fraud. She referenced the Skilling case, which is the case that was decided by the Supreme Court in July, that basically said you can no longer use the federal fraud statute to prosecute someone for failing to provide honest services unless that person took a bribe. So in the past, this is one of the biggest tools of federal prosecutors. Basically, it said that if you had a conflict of interest, you did not provide your constituents, whether it's the voters, the stockholders, with your honest services. The Supreme Court said, no, you cannot bring that anymore. You can only charge someone for failing to deliver honest services if they took a bribe. So that's really, that has taken a huge tool out of the tool belt of federal prosecutors.
And Richard, what's next? Do you think the identities of Congressman A or Congressman B will come out eventually?
I doubt it unless, you know, Mark Zacharias certainly knows who they are. And if he were, I mean, he conceivably could grant an interview today because he knows what his punishment is. There's nothing he can do to change it. But his attorney said he would advise him not to, and so I don't think we're going to know.
Richard Maurer is a reporter for the Anchorage Daily News. The Sitka Tribe of Alaska's Tribal Council has ousted one of their members. George Paul has been removed from the council. Five members found Paul guilty of neglect of duty and gross misconduct after deliberating a lengthy closed session last Wednesday night. Paul, along with three other council members, walked out of that executive session and the rest of the meeting, upset that the discussion of Paul's removal was being done out of public view. As KCAW's Ed Ronco reports, Paul's removal is effective immediately, but the debate surrounding it is far from over.
The charges against Paul were leveled by Council Chairman Lawrence Woody Widmark. He accused Paul of speaking on behalf of the tribe without authorization, specifically about STA's relationship with Search. He also says Paul made negative remarks toward STA staff during meetings and pointed to a disorderly conduct conviction Paul received in late September as reasons for his removal. The council moved to discuss Paul's future in an executive session without Paul's attorney present, which drew sharp criticism from members of the public and from some council members. Here's Tom Gamble.
If you're going to go into closed doors, go into closed doors without me, because I'm not going to be any part of setting people up so that a tribal chairman can work with a tribal attorney and three friends to remove anybody from the tribal council.
The motion was then changed to allow Paul's outside counsel into the executive session. Paul said he would waive his right to privacy and asked that the charges against him be discussed in the open. The council, though, voted to go into executive session. After about an hour, Paul and Gamble walked out of the session along with two other members of the council, Dale Williams and Archie Nielsen. Paul's attorney, Jim McGowan, also left the executive session. The four who walked out said they wanted discussion of Paul's removal to happen in public, and McGowan said while Paul would have been allowed to call witnesses to speak on his behalf, there were limitations placed on what could happen.
No, I mean, I think they might let the people come into the room, but they wouldn't let Mr. Paul present his case by asking them questions. So, he could bring cardboard cutouts in, and he'd get just as much out of them as a witness that he can't ask questions.
As the five members of the council met in a separate room, various members of the audience took turns at the council microphone in the main room, speaking against the process the council was using. After a while, Paul thanked those in attendance for their support and then left. The five members remaining voted openly to find Paul guilty of neglect of duty and gross misconduct, and then by secret ballot to remove him from the council. The secret ballot total was 5-0. After Wednesday night's meeting, Widmark declined to comment, deferring instead to Baines, who led the meeting. Baines said the hearing was held in executive session because of a lawsuit Paul has threatened against the tribe.
They gave us a letter from their attorney saying that they intend to sue us for slander, and if we brought it out into a public forum like this, that would have gave them ammunition for them to do exactly that.
That letter, written by Attorney Jim McGowan and obtained by KCAW, says Paul will take his case to the Federal Bureau of Indian Affairs if he's removed, and threatens a slander suit against council members who vote against Paul. The letter also spells out responses to the charges against Paul. McGowan argues that the time during which complaints can be filed on some of the charges has expired, and that when Paul spoke to various elected officials, he made clear he was not speaking on behalf of the tribe. He further argues that Paul did not neglect his duty by not participating on committees, but rather volunteered for one and was not appointed by Widmark. McGowan also challenges the tribe's right to consider Paul's conviction on disorderly conduct, which was a misdemeanor. The STA Constitution provides for removal of a council member who is convicted of a felony or other offenses involving dishonesty while in office. Reporting in Sitka, I'm Ed Ronco.
Alaska News Nightly is brought to you in part by the Doyon family of companies working together to build Alaska's future.
Alaska is home to a commonplace resource that is becoming scarce in many parts of the world. No, not oil, water. And an Alaska marketing expert tells us why we need to start thinking of water as a valuable commodity. KSKA's Ellen Lockyer has more.
Back in the heyday of Wally Hickel, there was a plan afloat to pipe fresh Alaska water to California via an undersea pipeline. Hickel needed to appoint a state water director to get the ball rolling.
I was the first director and the last director.
Rick Davidge was the only state water director ever. In 1993, he published a paper looking at the notion of global bulk water markets from an economic and ecological standpoint. As a result, he was faced with a number of applications to export water from Alaska.
I discovered as director that we had no legal framework within which to deal with that. Governor Hickel and I mustered some emergency legislation, which is now, in many cases, considered model legislation for countries or states that are looking at the notion of water exports and or imports.
That state law still stands. Since then, Davidge has formed Aqueous USA, a company which consults with countries and communities, large and small, which are interested in exporting or importing water. Davidge says a number of Alaska communities are looking at exporting local water.
Water has been exported and imported globally and between regions. Probably most immediately or historically in the Mediterranean, but then even Captain Cook was exporting water from Alaska.
It was Davidge who told Hickel that the water pipeline south was not viable economically or any other way. He says now subsea pipelines are too expensive to build or maintain.
And we have found that water transport bags are, in fact, much more reliable and cost-effective as opposed to subsea pipelines. For a lot of reasons. You can modify the delivery based on demand, either in scale or in schedule. You can have bags based on the market demand, etc.
He says inefficiency is the hallmark of most water delivery systems in this country.
The old laws or the old habits in water markets were the more you buy, the less you pay per unit, which encouraged waste.
Davidge says Alaska's law says the reverse. The more water taken, the higher the price paid to the state. Davidge says the water has to be developed and conveyed through a private entity. A state permit requires proof that the water taken is in excess of the needs of local communities.
So the state has to ensure that all these other needs are covered before they would approve an export. I advocate keeping enough water for the needs of the local communities, the ecology of the area, etc., out 50 years minimum.
Davidge says there is enough water for everybody on the planet. It's just that human populations tend to glom together in areas not where the water is. So the water has to be moved to where the population is gathered, and that's both costly and ultimately unsustainable. New delivery techniques demand a new perspective, too. He says water needs to be marketed according to its purity. A high pH value is the most pure for human consumption.
Particularly in the Western part of the world, we don't look at water based on its various characteristics. We look at water as water. Water is water. No, it's not. There are enormous variables in the quality of water.
Multiple water delivery systems are on the horizon, he says, where different quality waters are delivered to users. All uses don't require high-quality water.
Our strategy in America of providing all water at drinking water standard is just nuts. It's economically nuts. It's ecologically nuts. It just doesn't make any sense. And I'm delighted to see communities now moving towards the notion of having a potable and a non-potable water.
For instance, he says you don't need chlorinated water to wash the car or to water the lawn. Removing the chlorine from some water would reduce the amount of pollution in the environment. He says water bills are largely charged to pay off indebtedness to the cost of the infrastructure used to convey it. New ways of providing water will require new infrastructures, he says, to keep costs at a level consumers can live with. New technologies are on the horizon. Aqueous is working with new technologies to apply to desalinization techniques for coastal area water needs, ones that reduce harm to the environment. But Davidge cautions that Alaska won't be swapping its oil product for a water product anytime soon.
No, they're quite different markets, but I believe that in my lifetime, we will see bulk exports of water from Alaska to major global markets.
United Nations studies indicate that a point is coming by mid-century when more than half the people on the planet will not have adequate water. David says that point could come a lot sooner unless steps are taken to revise how the precious commodity is delivered. I'm Ellen Lockyer.
It's been 3 months since two Hoonah police officers, Matthew Tokuoka and Anthony Wallace, were murdered by a local resident. 45-year-old John Marvin Jr. is accused of the killings. The town was left without law enforcement protection after the deaths, since a third officer was allowed to take leave after the tragedy. Officer Joe Mills is back at work, and a new police academy graduate, David Lindstrom, has recently joined the force. But during the bleak months after the deaths of the two officers, police personnel from all over Southeast Alaska donated time and expertise to bring police protection to the remote town. KHNS reporter Tara Bicknell spoke with one of the officers who filled in for his fallen comrades and brings us this story.
Alaska State Trooper Josh Bentz was one of two Haines-based law enforcement officials who stood in for the fallen Hoonah officers. He was in the southeast village of about 800 residents for about a week in September.
From the minute that it happened, they had extra law enforcement in town. And then once the memorial service was finished, there were law enforcement officers that remained there and will remain there for 6 to 12 months is what I was told.
Trooper Bentz grew up in Juneau, just 40 miles from Hoonah, and made many trips there for school and travel over the years. He never met the two village officers who died, but another Haines official who filled in Hoonah did, Sergeant Jason Joel with the Haines Police Department, who said it was hardest to sit in the offices of the deceased men, which were still just the way they were the night officers Matt Tokuoka and Tony Wallace responded to their last call. Bentz agreed.
The weirdest part was sitting in their office, you know, and there's pictures of them and their family up on the walls, and like they had just been there, and they had just been there. It was just kind of surreal.
But the warmer side of the temporary job was obvious, too. Both Sergeant Joel and Trooper Bentz acknowledged that.
Yep. Multiple people came up to me and said, you know, I really appreciate you being here. I got, you know, waves from pretty much everybody that was out and about. When I was around town, out of uniform even, people recognized me and thanked me.
Bent says it's likely that stand-in law enforcement will have to remain in Hoonah for at least several more months.
Even though I never met them, I kind of felt, after going there, that I knew a little bit about them just from sitting where they sat and patrolling the streets that they patrolled. And, you know, you really feel for the families. I would go again if they needed me.
That story by Haines reporter Tara Bicknell. And that's all for this edition of Alaska News Nightly. If you missed any of tonight's stories, we're online at APRN.org. You can follow us on Twitter at APRN. We had reports tonight from Ellen Lockyer in Anchorage, Angela Denning Barnes in Bethel, Jacob Resnick in Kodiak, Ed Ronco in Sitka, and Tara Bicknell in Haines. Our audio engineer is Dave Waldron, and I'm Laurie Townsend. Good night.
Alaska News Nightly was made possible by
Fire Island Wind, offering a fuel-free energy alternative to South Central Alaska natural gas. Learn more at fireislandwind.com.
Didn't quite catch that report? Want to hear it again? APRN can be heard on the web at www.aprn.org.
This is APRN, the Alaska Public Radio Network.